Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we are so pleased today to have a good friend of the show back with us. Brad Wilcox of the National Marriage Project is a leading voice when it comes to family and marriage. His book, Get Married, is a must-read, and we're so happy that he could make the time for us. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Mary, and Ashley as well.
Well, one of the reasons we were so eager to have you on this week was this new poll released by NBC News Desk, which looked at Gen Z, that particular demographic, and specifically their views on marriage and happiness. So this poll has really gone viral, as the kids say, all over social media and in the news. What was your first reaction, Brad, as someone who studies this issue in depth?
Yeah, you know, Mary, we've been seeing kind of an ideological polarization kind of playing out where young women are moving to the left culturally and politically, and young men are moving to the right culturally and politically. But I think we haven't necessarily understood how much of it's connected to divergent views about the good life and how important marriage and family figure versus work and independence. And what this new poll does is sort of underline that for female voting Harris, I mean, women voting for Harris, young women voting for Harris, the most important thing the poll found was kind of having a job or career that they found fulfilling, and then having enough money to do the things that they wanted to do, kind of, you know, fun things, maybe travel, et cetera. And the least important things for women, young women voting for Harris were getting married and then having kids. And by contrast, for the young men voting for Trump, the number one thing that they were talking about was actually having kids. And then number four was being married. So a lot more importance for the Trump voting young men on marriage and family. So kind of just underlines this sort of divergent orientation that maps out onto some larger ideological divides playing out in American life. But again, this was, I think, so kind of eye-opening because it was showing how work versus marriage and family are kind of playing out both along kind of partisan and gender lines in young adult culture today, Mary.
Brad, one of the things that stuck out to me was the money factor. And it seemed like certainly there's a bit of like a selfish component here. Like, you know, people want to have their fun and they want money because they want to go on trips and girls' weekends. But I do wonder if there is a real fear about money being an impediment to having a family. And, you know, as a mom of five kids, you know, how do we address the real costs of having kids? There are costs, childcare, healthcare, education. But how do we kind of help young people to overcome that as a fear and an impediment to forming families?
So yeah, I think it's important that we kind of acknowledge too, that I think for a good number of young women, they have the perception, and it's grounded in reality, that there are not enough kind of guys out there who have their act together, who are doing reasonably well when it comes to their performance in the workplace, their potential as breadwinners for a family. And so if you're kind of looking around and seeing a lot of guys struggling, I think you're more likely to put a premium on making money and being financially independent, either for yourself or for any family you might form down the road. So I think it's part of why we have seen a lot of younger women kind of key in more on career and financial success, because a lot of the young men in their worlds are not doing so well. So that's part of, I think, the challenge facing them. But then I think too, there's just kind of for everyone, there's a challenge in terms of just affordability, family affordability, actually, particularly in more metro areas like the DC metro area, I think, where you're from, and other places where the cost of housing especially is extremely high. And people are worried about kind of making enough money to be able to support their families, raise kids, you know, put a roof over their head. So that's a big problem. And I think in terms of on the policy side, I would just say two things quickly. One is we need to be thinking about measures, especially at the local level, to make housing cheaper and more abundant, especially single family housing for working class and middle class families. That's, I think, a huge need out there, priority that could be occupying the attention of policymakers. And then on the federal level, just doing a better job with expanding the child tax credit. Mm-hmm. I'd say especially for families with younger children, just to kind of give them more financial latitude to invest in their families and their kids and to not be as concerned about, you know, making ends meet. And unfortunately, in the most recent legislative process, the Senate, actually Republican Senate, downgraded the CTC from $2,500 to $2,200 compared to what the House was initially suggesting. That's what, what Congress went with. And so like, the Republicans in the Senate, actually, to be honest, haven't been sufficiently attentive to the financial challenges facing ordinary families.
Brad, one of the things that surprised me about the poll, and I guess this is because in the Catholic Church, at least, we're coming off the canonization of two young saints, two young men, one 15 and one, I think, 22, and tens of thousands of young people filling St. Peter's Square. But the one kind of unifying thread among all the people who were polled was that their faith ranked last or near last for almost every group. And so I guess I'm juxtaposing that particular fact, snapshot of fact, I guess, against the tens of thousands of young people there for a canonization of saints, and wondering, is this more of an American phenomenon, do you think? That because my sense is, at least among the Trump voting men, faith was a big component. I mean, Bishop Bob Barron has a huge following. Other people, who Michael Knowles, for example, all these sort of faith-based podcasters have huge followings among young men. Was that a surprise to you?
So we have been kind of seeing in general, Mary, as you well know, the sort of drift in the last really 55 years has been towards, America taking a turn away from faith, away from religion. A lot of discussion, among scholars about the rise of the nuns, and we're not talking about NUNSs, we're talking about NONESs, right? In the broader American public, with a lot of young adults kind of abandoning any kind of faith. At the same time, though, we have seen it looks like this sort of like decline in religion has bottomed out, according to polls from Pew, for instance, and there's other evidence from a survey at the American Enterprise Institute, for instance, that suggests that Gen Z could be a bit more religious than the millennial generation, especially younger Gen Z men. And certainly, anecdotally, what I see at the University of Virginia, Mary, is that our Catholic Who's group, this is the Catholic student group at the University of Virginia, is larger and stronger than ever and has a lot of young men. So I think anecdotally, I've heard a similar story for other professors at other universities. So I think there is a bit of an upsurge that we're seeing kind of play out among young adults, but it has to be understood in terms of, playing out against a context where there's been a big shift in the last, again, 55 years. Towards secularization. And so it's going to be, I think, a while before we see any kind of market upturn potentially that's being manifested in national polls for our younger adults.
So it was interesting, right around the time that this poll or data was released, there was new data that came out that showed that despite birth rates being at an all-time low, ideal family size is still over two children. And you're really kind of a research machine. Tell us about some of the research that you've done or that you find of note, especially in the last year or two. That shows, I think you have data about conservative women being the happiest in their marriages, that women prefer male breadwinners, that might kind of misalign a little bit with some of what this poll showed.
Yeah, so what we do see in the data is that basically younger women who kind of lean right tend to be happier than younger women who lean left. They're also more likely to be married as well. And I think part of the story there is that, and this is based upon work done by Jonathan Haidt, for instance, and Jean Twenge, who are social psychologists, is they're kind of finding that young women who lean left tend to be more likely to be kind of worried about the state of America, the state of society. I think that's part of it. But as I look at kind of like, gaps in happiness, for instance, between more conservative and more progressive adults more generally, including younger women, what I find is that about a third of that gap can be attributed to the fact that conservative Americans are more likely to be married in the first place and then more likely to be happily married in the second place. So I think part of this sort of happiness gap we see between conservatives and liberals more generally. Can be kind of traced to the way in which conservatives today, especially, are more likely to put a premium on getting married and to be more likely to end up being happily married as well. And that has a big impact on their sort of global emotional well-being, too, in ways that extend beyond just sort of their ideology.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think when you sort of look at this sort of this the civic landscape and the cultural landscape, what you see is that conservatives are more likely to be religious, and religious institutions continue to be more likely to stress marriage and family, for instance. They're also more likely to be kind of listening to and paying attention to and watching, both religious and conservative media platforms like the one that we're on right now. A Daily Wire would be another good example of, a conservative platform that's really kind of come to the fore. And these platforms are much more likely to be kind of marriage and family friendly, compared to more progressive platforms, which tend to kind of discount the importance or just sort of pass over, the importance of marriage, and kind of like, MSNBC, for instance. So I think that's also part of the story that's playing out both civically and in terms of media coverage as well.
Well, Brad, another point of unity among a lot of the people who were polled, particularly the young women, one third of young women said that they feel anxious almost all the time. An additional third reported being anxious most of the time. And in contrast, just under 2 in 10 Gen Z men report feeling anxious at those levels. What do you attribute that particular polling point to?
Well, I think one thing it's important to note is that there are, there are kind of these sort of average differences that we see playing out in the research more generally between women and men, where in general, women are more likely to be anxious and depressed compared to men. So I think that's part of the dynamic that, could be socialization, could be, some kind of biological differences, but there's just something about kind of the broader trend here that's worth noting. But it's also the case too, as John Haidt has pointed out and Jean Twenge has pointed out, that it's especially the case that liberal women are especially anxious and depressed. And I think that's in part because their social media is more likely to be painting a negative portrait of kind of society, relationships, family, and other things that might kind of shape the emotional sort of cast of their lives as well. So, a lot of what people do nowadays is stare at screens. And if your kind of social media algorithm is sort of steering you towards more what's called catastrophic, messaging, I think that's probably going to have an impact too on your well-being. And I think one more kind of important point too is there's a kind of like comparison thing happening as well, where if you're spending a lot of time in social media, you're going to be kind of picking up on ways where you're less likely to be, attending that party or enjoying that outfit or that trip to Paris or Miami, whatever it might be. So social media allows, I think, women who spend more time online oftentimes to have the sense that they don't kind of measure up to some imagined peers on the internet as well.
Speaking of social media, I've noticed a trend on social media, and I'm probably more attuned to it because it directly impacted somebody who kind of fell prey to this sort of pro-divorce, woman power thing going on like Instagram and TikTok. Like they call themselves divorce doulas, and they're basically just social media influencers who are trying to, I don't know, destigmatize divorce. Which I found interesting because I feel like the data I'm seeing is that divorce is on the decline. And when I saw, you mentioned women's anxiety about being unable to find a partner, I wonder too if some of this is women being afraid of potentially finding themselves divorced and in a bad financial situation. So, I don't, what do you see as what's actually going on right now with divorce trends?
So obviously, I think everyone knows people who've gotten divorced or are getting divorced in their circles these days. And there are obviously people who are kind of going through divorces online and in public platforms. And that might kind of distort people's thinking. But we are seeing is that kind of in the real world, actually, divorce is down from a peak in around 1981. It's come down more than 40% since the early 1980s. And what that means today is that whereas one in two marriages ended in divorce back around 1980, and that was kind of like the expectation that people had at that point in time, and so they still think that's true today, we're seeing probably less than 40%, so 4 in 10 of first marriages are going to end in divorce. And it looks like that's coming down. So, in part because marriage is more selective for people who are more educated, more affluent, and more religious. We are seeing again for most couples, both that they're going the distance and that their odds of divorce are coming down. And that's something we have to kind of bear in mind when you sort of see these more public marriages, having difficulty and then landing in divorce court.
Well, Brad, before we let you go, and I know this could quite possibly just be a doctoral dissertation question, but if you had to say rank on a scale of 1 to 10 the importance of political affiliation when people are looking for marriage partners, where would you rank that for women and where would you rank it for men?
What we call homogamy is really important in family and marital success. That means just sort of being on the same page with your spouse. And if you'd asked me this question, Mary, about 30 years ago, I would say maybe number six, seven, eight, I don't know, somewhere down, important, but not that important. Whereas today I would put it more like, maybe four or three, and it's just because politics, for better and for worse, has emerged as a key social divide in America. And so we need to be attentive to whether or not we're kind of on the same page on the political front as well.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for giving us your time today. And it's always so good to hear your insights and opinions. And listeners, to learn more about Brad Wilcox, you can visit the nationalmarriageproject.org and check out harpercollins.org for Brad's excellent book. Brad, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Ashley.
Thanks, Brad.
You know what? Why don't we talk about a little bit about what I mentioned at the beginning, which is the I guess the University of Texas at Austin calls it the economics of sex, where they have that excellent video that they did, and they look at sex, mating, and marriage from an economic perspective. And they talk about, I guess what you would say in business would be like the entry point for someone into, for men, it's the interest in having a regular sexual partner. For women, it's companionship. There's also the physical intimacy, which is important to women. But for women, it's more wanting to start a family and having, security and physical and emotional intimacy with someone. And the University of Texas at Austin, their Marriage Institute, looked at the changes, the way in which this has changed over the decades, and basically found that now, because men do have access to, things like OnlyFans and porn and, hookup apps are everywhere, that their interest in really having a long-term, physically intimate partner is not the same that it would have been 50 years ago. So the whole shift of what women's buying power is, has been so dramatic that whereas it used to be at a minimum, you'd have to be engaged with to someone before you'd sleep with them. Now, apparently, there is an expectation among 20 and 30 somethings that no, we minimally, you got to live with me for a couple years, and then I'll see if I like how this is working out, and then maybe I'll ask you to marry me. We're from slightly different generations, Ashley. How are you seeing this among kind of your peers or maybe people a little bit younger?
Well, it's interesting because some of Brad's, I think it's Brad's research, found that women who had had whose only sexual partner was the person they married reported the highest levels of marital happiness and were the least likely to divorce. So I have no doubt, that the landscape has changed, but what hasn't changed is that marriage makes women happy. It's sort of a an insurance policy, a happiness insurance policy. And that has not changed with the generations. And it's just really tragic. And I would use the word heartbreaking, the response or my response to that poll that we were just discussing with Brad, because to see young men and young women, with the exception obviously of of male Trump voters, rank the thing that is most likely to give meaning to their life and happiness at the very bottom, that we have our work cut out for us in terms of shaping hearts and minds and helping people to just achieve happiness. And your point about the expectation of cohabitation now, I do wonder if marriage has lost its appeal because women, as you say, the sort of dynamics and relationships have totally flipped. And now, living together is sort of like a cheap imitation of marriage, but it's coarsened for women. So If they're thinking this is what marriage is going to be like, then of course they're not going to want to get married. But that's not what marriage is like, because
That's
you
so
start
correct.
out with a lifelong commitment before anything else.
Right. And then you work back from that. But I wonder how many of those women, particularly the Harris voters, might have given that answer because they believe that that's what's expected of them, that they shouldn't put down that they want to get married, that that's somehow, being dismissive of all the years that they spent obtaining their educations or their expertise in something, right? You do kind of see sort of a herd mentality. I think with some of these types of social changes when they happen, and then, when they go back and look at their lives later, some of the things you talk to people in their 50s who either divorced or, were seriously involved with someone but never, quote unquote, pulled the trigger and got married. And it's one of their biggest regrets, right? But, what's that old saying? Youth is wasted on the young. But, I have two daughters who are in their early 20s, and, they've expressed to me just how difficult it seems to be for men to do sort of the normal socialization things. Like one of my daughters was attending the TLM, the traditional Latin mass, in a large urban city, and she said there was a very nice looking young man, and every Sunday the pew in which he sat got closer to hers. But for 6 months he never even said hello to her, never asked her name, never, and then she wound up moving to another city, and 2 weeks into her going to mass at her new parish, a young man came over and said, "Hi, my name is so and so. Would you like to grab a cup of coffee with me?" And I said, "Well, he's got to be, this has got to be a kid from a small town or something like that." She goes, "Yeah, he's from some small town in Wisconsin." And I thought, well, that's, unlike big cities, I think, where people just don't interact in a super friendly, neighborly way, I think it's a skill that you can learn, thankfully. This is not something that's innate. I'm either outgoing or I'm not. I mean, we have our natural temperaments, but still, I don't think we're spending any time teaching young people how to court, what courtship is like.
Yeah.
And, again, it's a skill. What's that class, actually? You and I think we've talked about this at is it at Boston College, where it's an entire semester class on dating?
Oh, I
And
haven't heard about that, but
oh, and
interesting.
it's You it fills up within 3 seconds of it being posted every single semester. And part of your homework or your final exam is that you have to ask somebody out or accept a date from someone by the time the class is over, and then write about it. You have to write a paper about it. And it doesn't have to be somebody in the class. They're not trying to do matchmaking in the class. But some of the men who have taken the class, and again, they're taking it to learn how to, just stuff. Like either they didn't grow up with a dad, or it just was never part of their formation as young men, as gentlemen, to learn how to ask a young woman out. And I think we get a little bit more of that kind of training, even informally, from our mothers or our girlfriends or what have you. But there was a story in like the Boston Globe or the New York Times about it, even because everyone was so surprised that this class has become so like instantly popular.
Well, I believe it because the percent of dating that happens online now and is, staggering. And now when I meet young couples and ask them how they met, it's almost always
Yes.
online. And I know that's not what people want. And I have nothing against online dating. It's a solution to a problem, but it's a band-aid that doesn't solve, even once you get to the point of being on a date, there's more social skills that are required.
There
So
was there was a huge stigma about online dating when it first started. And you would like almost be made fun of if you met the person you were dating online. And people, in fact, so much so, people would just be very discreet. And, I have a friend who met his wife on Catholic Match. And but when people asked him, "Where did you meet your wife?" he would always say, "I met her at the airport," because that was the first place he met her, because she flew in to see him, because he didn't want to admit to anybody. They've been married like 25 years now, but he still didn't want to admit to anybody he met her online.
And now when I mean, I'm talking about college kids. They're at college, but they're meeting each other online.
Yeah.
And college is probably one of the last settings where you're going to
Right.
be, in an easy dating environment.
Exactly.
Well, Mary, we have to wrap, but what an interesting conversation with
Yes.
Brad. And we've got work to do in terms of shaping hearts and minds to see marriage as something desirable and part of a successful life.
Right. And a very blessed life. You know, it's a beautiful vocation and most people are called to it. And you know, I had written a thing, an article about this for First Things during the conclave, where I talked about how, as a Catholic Church, I think we could do better in this area. You know, the Orthodox Jews are very good about fixing up young men with compatible young women from compatible families. And they really make that a priority in terms of helping their children out. And I think that we could take a page or two from that book.
I totally agree.
All right. Well, we will see you then at our next taping. Great to have a conversation with you today, Ashley.
You too, Mary.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com. And we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversation.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we are thrilled to have joining us for the first time the one and only Emily Zanotti, written several stories on so many cultural and family topics that affect us all. Most recently, her Substack that went viral on, of all things, cooking and how it's an integral part of the domestic church. So welcome to the show, Emily. We are so pleased to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, people throw around that word influencer, but you really are an influencer. You have such a gift and of not only just kind of picking up on cultural moments, but of doing it with such good humor. And, you know, I feel like I know and love your children already. They're just, and I think, you know, as the youngsters would say, you make yourself vulnerable by sharing those moments that, you know, we've sort of all faced as wives and mothers and, you know, just human beings. But I'd love to start with the story about cooking because surprised people got as crazy about it as they did. And
yeah, me too.
Probably, like in my Twitter bio, I have cookbook hoarder because I have more cookbooks than any human being could possibly justify having. And my children make fun of me for it, but I just love them. I find them so comforting. And I'm a person who really loves to cook, but you were left without a kitchen, which is, oh my goodness, what a horrific thing. And as because you had like a flooding incident.
Yes. So yeah. Our refrigerator, we moved into a new house about a year and a half ago. And the people who had lived here previously did a lot of upgrading work, but they did it DIY. And unfortunately, I think a lot of our plumbing was done over YouTube. Like they learned from YouTube. So we had to go through and fix a lot. And in one instance, they actually hooked up a hot water line to the back of our fridge to the ice maker, and the hot water melted all the parts.
Oh,
so
no.
We had a lake in our kitchen, a lake in our basement. So we had a 7 month. It just finished.
Oh my God.
We put in the last tile last week. So it was about a 7 month ordeal, and we had to move out of the house. Our kids were living in an Airbnb for a while. It was something I never want to endure again.
Oh, please. Please tell me that the insurance covered almost everything and allowed you to get a fabulous new kitchen.
Yeah, thankfully. And it was allowed us to upgrade a little bit on some things. For instance, I do also have a cookbook collection and I got to have cookbook bookshelves put into my kitchen island. So
we would be dangerous if we lived near each other, Emily. That's fantastic.
So Emily, tell us about You in your article for the National Catholic Register, you talk about how you your experience without a kitchen, you realized deprived your family not just of the functionality of a kitchen, but sort of the, you describe it, I think, as the domestic church of your home. Or tell us what that article was about and what you meant by that in terms of the deeper loss of not having a kitchen.
So for me, quite realize that the kitchen was the heart of the domestic church. We took it for granted. I think anybody who lives in a house and you go every day and you have a kitchen that maybe you don't really like, but you use a lot, you don't really realize how much is tied to that room. It's where you cook your meals, it's where you eat your meals, it's where you group together as a family. It's where we say our prayers every night, and in the at the breakfast table and the dinner table, we go over our prayer list every day. And we didn't realize when we lost that how much we were losing in terms of what held our family together. Eating dinners and breakfasts on the sofa, watching the TV, we all sort of zoned out. We no longer felt like we were getting together every night as a family. There was that cohesion that was missing. And I sort of talk about it, about my mom and my grandmother, who both of them didn't necessarily pass down the cooking skills, but the memories that I have of their kitchens are the love and the warmth and being fed and understood and heard at that kitchen table. And I wanted to pass that down to my kids. And it didn't really occur to me that until I didn't have a kitchen, that that was going to really have an impact on that.
You know, Emily, were you surprised by, I guess, sort of the intensity of the reactions to what you wrote about that most people, they don't really hate cooking, they just don't really know how to cook. And some of them, like, I think my mother just assumed that by osmosis, I would be able to, figure out everything, the way she made every meal, et cetera, et cetera. And I think then later in life realized I hadn't, so I had to, but it's a skill that you can learn, right? And then that's, hence my 10,000 cookbooks. But I have now become very intentional. I read some kind of like going off to college survival guide for my eldest daughter, and it said your child should be able to cook at least three meals, something for breakfast, something for like a real meal, start to finish, and should know how to do that by the time they're 21. They should be able to cook one meal for each of the three main meals of the day. That's an actual substantive meal. So I've really made a very intentional point of showing my girls how to do that. And now I mean, for the most part, they really do love to cook. But what do you attribute some of the crazier responses that you got to this to? Were people, do you think they were personally insulted or thought you were making fun of them, or what
It
was strange in
started
all of that?
on Twitter, I guess X. I responded to somebody saying, "Cooking is so expensive. I can order DoorDash every day, and it would still be cheaper than cooking in my kitchen." And I was just shocked at that. I was like, "There's absolutely no way." I have a family of five, and we probably average about $150 to $200 a week for food. And when I was in during this remodel, we ate out a lot. I can tell you that it was significantly more than cooking from scratch.
And it gets very old very fast, doesn't it? The eating out
All
thing.
I wanted was just, I wanted chicken piccata. I told my husband like a million times. I was like, this is a dish I cook all the time. You guys are so sick of it, but that's all I wanted because it just didn't taste like it was from a restaurant. And all of a sudden, all these people start responding and saying, "Well, I don't know how to cook. What do you mean? What do you mean it's cheaper? Well, has anyone ever taught you how to stock a pantry? Has anyone ever told you what pans you need? What you should go to Williams-Sonoma or Target and purchase for your kitchen? What are these tools that are required?" And everyone was just like, "Nobody taught me that." And it became a combination of maybe in the last generation, moms were working more outside of the house. So either dinner was something that they threw together really quickly, or kids grew up eating out, eating at the table one at a time over time, and nobody really sat down to a meal. I think that is part of it. I think also we removed home ec from schools in the last 30 years. And this has become kind of a crusade for me. Unknowingly and unwittingly, I decided that this was, like just led into this sort of thing. But we took home ec out. And so the basics of knowing how to measure flour and knowing that you need a measuring cup and knowing that you need a chef's knife, those things just disappeared. And so people are going online and they're going to influencers and getting recipes and they're laying five of those out a week and they all have different ingredients and they just were making cooking really difficult and expensive on themselves. So I think people just resonated with, yeah, I actually have never learned those things. I have never had that contact with food and with cooking and
It's interesting. I grew up in a big family. I was the oldest of five, and by the time I was a teenager, it was my job to make one family meal a night. I'm sorry, a week. There was a night of the week that was mine. And it's an essential life skill because now I'm a mom and now I have five kids. And you absolutely need to know how to cook efficiently, thrift with thrift, how to use leftovers to your advantage. And it's something that I'm teaching my oldest daughter now too. And frankly, it helps, when you have a lot of kids to be able to say, okay, you're doing the sauteed potatoes tonight. But when reading your articles, I was reminded of an article that came out in The Atlantic, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, about how kitchens are more expensive than ever. Everybody's got all these gadgets, all this, the Wolf range and the this and that. But the amount of time people spend in the kitchen is at an all-time low. What do you think about that? Why is that? Why, apart from the skill gap, why are people so into their fancy kitchens but then don't use them?
I think for the same reasons that they're into the fancy entertainment systems and don't use them, it's a keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like it all has to look different. It all has to look better. It all has to look beautiful. The houses have to look beautiful. We're obsessed with the aesthetics. And the funny thing is that you mentioned it. I have always wanted a Wolf range. And I saved up for years and sold clothes on Poshmark and then finally got the chance to get one. And I hugged it when it was taken off the truck in the middle of the street. I was so excited. And it shocks me that actually there are, other people that I know who have these same ranges in their kitchens and they absolutely never use them. And it's just, I think it's just a inherited from that last generation that just came away from cooking. I am really intentional with getting my kids to cook. There are pictures in the article of me having like a baby. I'm baby wearing while I'm making Thanksgiving dinner. My kids have been in the kitchen since they were teeny tiny. They all know how to cook. They could possibly feed themselves for an entire weekend. I wouldn't even have to like, I wouldn't even have to talk to them. But hopefully that reverses that, where they don't think of the kitchen as just another accessory for your house. They think of it as a real heart of a home.
One of the things I was thinking of when you talk about the kitchen sort of being for women, at least in the domestic church, kind of your inner sanctum, that's your sancta sanctorum. And I was thinking of, I mean, invariably Thanksgiving, particularly on Thanksgiving, everyone decides to come and stand in the kitchen. And my husband will stand in front of the one drawer I need to get into at any given moment. And it's just become like a ongoing family joke. Like, why are you all in here? Get
Why
out.
are you even here?
And I love them all, but I like that feeling of being in there and being in the moment, particularly for a holiday, because you want everything, you have a little extra desire to make it a really special meal. And you should be grateful that everyone wants to come in and be in your, in your orbit. But it also, at the same time, I mean, for me at least, has led to some times where, I've acted with an incredible lack of charity towards my family because I'm so mad that they're in my inner space. What do you think would be a good way to help sort of explain that concept to the family in a way that doesn't alienate them from the kitchen, but helps them to understand what it means to you as a mom and a wife and a chef, to have that kind of time there on your own?
I think this is a school lunch problem for our house. We don't homeschool. We have an amazing Catholic school that's just around the corner, so it's amazing. But we actually do still have to make the lunches, which is and my husband every morning, like slowly walking around the island in front of every single thing I need. And I've learned that I will just evict them. but my kids don't have a boundary when it comes to the kitchen. That is actually the one drawback of having them in my kitchen all the time, is that they just invite themselves in and they're like, oh, you're breading chicken. I want to have monster fingers too. Sometimes I have to enlist the help of my husband to just be like, we need a little space. We haven't run into the injury thing yet, but part of it is just a safety thing, especially with the gas range. They like to reach over and stir and taste, and we just have to have a boundary there. And constantly telling them mom just needs 20 minutes to cloak Bluey. And that is in every aspect of life, right? Like sometimes mom just needs 20 minutes, and the kitchen is no exception.
What would you say to moms, I think, who, especially moms who are working outside the home? I think you're absolutely right that like the influencer culture makes people overthink dinner. And I remember once somebody asking me, how can I possibly cook 6 nights a week? And I'm like, well, it's a lot of tacos and spaghetti, like I'm not making beef bourguignon every night. But what would be a piece of advice you would have for busy moms, whether they're juggling a lot of young kids, or busy carpool schedules or work, who want to cook more?
I think there's two things you can do. One is meal planning. Sitting down on a Sunday, even for just a few minutes, I sit down and I write out what I'm going to make. And then I make my Kroger delivery list from that. That doesn't always go as planned. We once had a shipment of 40 bananas, and it's not as much fun as going to the grocery store on your own, but it does keep you on the straight and narrow a little bit and lets you sit down and look at recipes and then maybe swap things in and out for convenience or time. And it does look a lot like tacos and spaghetti. We have a rotating, probably 12 to 15 meals that we do. We share it, but it doesn't matter what you're serving. I think that's where we all sort of get caught up in this Top Chef Food Network culture. We want to make these beautiful plates and have gas streaks and foams and, things like that. On Sundays for Sunday dinner, I will try things like that. I will do the beef bourguignon, I will do the roast chicken. But truthfully, hamburger helper, sloppy joes. Some nights it's turkey burgers. Tonight is turkey burgers because we have baseball and dance. It's more the act of making that food and sharing it with your family than it is anything else. We live in a really health conscious society. I know people want to avoid processed foods, and I get that, but it's actually okay to serve your kid a hot dog or you have hot dogs once in a while for dinner. But it's just more important to make that connection than it is to worry about what's on the plate.
Are you a fan of the big batch cooking? And then related question, who are like your go-to people when you're thinking, oh man, I need a quick family recipe for tonight, that isn't a hot dog. And who do you kind of look up instinctively?
Instinctively, I look up Ina Garten. I love her recipes. They're
Yeah,
super
she's
easy.
really transformed cooking, like from cooking to assembling. Just
To
get stuff in
assembling.
season and assemble it. It's genius.
All of her recipes go together. So you can make a roast chicken on a Sunday. You can have chicken soup the next night. You can have, the leftovers the night after. They all seem to go together and they run together. I stick with her. I do like Smitten Kitchen. That's a good one. She has a really great underlying, she's very talented in that. She has the technique, and that's what you kind of have to watch for a lot with cooking influencers, is that they maybe don't have that same technique. And so if they don't have that background, you might not be able to get a good recipe out of them. I also have a lot of cookbooks from the early days of Food Network, early Giada De Laurentiis, early Mario Batali. I use Julia Child a lot. People who these cookbooks have stood the test of time
Right,
for a
exactly. They're
reason.
classics for a reason. No, for
They're
sure.
classics for a reason, and you can try it on a Sunday when you want to do a big meal, and then can keep doing it and get better at it. It gets much faster. But those are basically my go-tos.
Yeah, and early Martha Stewart, I found
Yes.
as a new mom and a new bride, were very helpful because it describes some of the things that you mentioned from home ec. What kind of pots and pans you should have, what kind of, knives that you need for a basic kitchen setup, that kind of thing. And I just think it's one of those things where people think they, I don't know why there's so much shame attached in the culture to not knowing how to cook, but there seems to be, which I just find very intriguing.
It's so strange because it's such an there's no barrier to entry on it.
Right.
If you
But it's so
want
true.
to
I know somebody who just told me once, I don't cook. And I'm kind of like, it's not that hard. You just turn the water on. I mean, what do you mean I don't cook?
Right.
Well,
And if you want to raise it up a notch, there's lots of great books. Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat is one that's mentioned in both of those articles. And that's a culinary degree in one book. And it's super easy to get to. It's super accessible, and it'll teach you without me having to tell you.
Well, Emily, we could
Well,
just sit and trade recipes and talk to you all. You'll have to come back. I hope that you will, but we can't let you go. We've been asked by some of your fans that we must ask you about Kevin the Chicken, that no conversation with you is complete without the infamous chicken named Kevin.
the infamous chicken. Well, sadly, Kevin passed away last
Oh,
year. Yeah, Kevin passed away of an unknown condition.
no. Okay.
But I have extremely good news in that Kevin's sister had children, and we have five of those babies. So
Oh, wonderful.
Kevin has sadly passed on. However, we now have Dave, Carl, Jerry, and Bob, and all four of them are Kevin's nieces, and they all have inherited Kevin's gift of chaos.
Yeah, well, I wonder, was Kevin, could Kevin have been ultimately responsible for the kitchen mishap?
It's
Or was,
possible.
yeah, it sounds like Kevin's little, what are they? Little paws or whatever they are on a chicken. What's on a chicken? What's the foot on a chicken? Chicken feet are all over it. I don't know what one calls that.
Talons.
Well, to learn more about Emily Zanotti, her family of chickens and her children and her cooking, you can check out all of her writings at ncregister.com. And you can also go to her Substack, emilyzanotti.substack.com. And to learn more about the Catholic Association and follow everything that we do in radio, TV, and print, you can find out a little bit more at thecatholicassociation.org. And you can also check online and in your local communities for our writing and our podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us today, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where we are joined with our wonderful resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Thanks for joining us once again, Monsignor.
Great to be with you, Betsy.
We have a really beautiful feast on Sunday. Would you tell us about it?
It's the Feast of the Triumph or the Exaltation of the Cross. This is a feast that's well known to daily Mass goers because we pretty much have it every year. But for those who aren't able to get to Mass during the week, we only are able to celebrate it on Sunday on average once every 6 years or so. This is one of those years. And so it's a very important part. It's a very important opportunity for us to focus on the cross in our authentic Catholic spirituality. In a lot of ways, we're living in a culture, Betsy, in which we run away from suffering. We don't want to focus on death. And looking at Jesus on the cross can be a little revolting. We see what, for example, our sins have done and leading to a suffering, but especially in some of the crucifixes, the real crucifixes that show what his suffering was like, we can turn away from that because it's just such torture and death to the one that we ought to love the most. And so that's one of the reasons why the first Christians often didn't use any images of the cross because it was just too much for them to handle, in addition to the persecutions of the time and everything else. But for us, we need to learn from St. Paul. St. Paul tried to teach the early Christians a proper understanding of the cross. He said that the cross was his sole boast. He would boast in nothing other than the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. That when we look at the cross, we see not just a subject of public execution and pain, but of the love of Jesus that made that much pain and that type of death bearable. And we're called to live that understanding of the cross. St. Paul likewise said in his letter to the first Christians in Galatia that he had been crucified with Christ through all his sufferings and all his own problems. He had been crucified with Christ, and the life he now lived in the flesh, he lived by faith in the Son of God who loved him and gave his life up for him. And so all of us are meant, especially this upcoming Sunday, to ponder the reality of the cross in our life. We make the sign of the cross over ourselves, not just at the beginning and the end of Mass, but often every time we pray, we make the sign of the cross whenever we enter into the church and dip our finger in the holy water font. We make it when we pray our grace. We're always making that sign of the cross. When we bring babies to be baptized, the first thing that the church does is the priest or the deacon or the bishop marks the baby's forehead with the sign of the cross, and then the parents and the godparents do the same. And when I prepare young families for baptism, I say, why would we make the sign of the cross? And they'll say, well, it's blessing the baby, but why would we bless a baby in a cruciform way? Would we ever stamp them with a noose or a guillotine or an electric chair? Of course not, because we want the best for them. So why are we marking them with the sign of the cross? Because we recognize that the Christian life is a school of the cross. It's a school of a love like Jesus. Jesus called us as his greatest and new commandment to love one another as he has loved us first, and he loved us by and through the cross. And so that's its centrality in the Christian life, and we have a chance not just to mark that reality, but to celebrate its triumph, because when we look at Jesus in the cross, we see the happiest person who ever lived at the moment of his supreme triumph, not shame. And we have signed up voluntarily to follow that crucified man in that school of love. And so this is a time in which we are reconstituted in who we really are. There's something else important happening on Sunday, though.
Okay, great.
We're celebrating Pope Leo's 70th birthday. And so these milestone birthdays for any family member, we always celebrate with a little greater love. This Sunday, we're going to be celebrating Pope Leo's 70th birthday, and we should do it with ever greater love in our prayer. If we're suffering in any way, it would be a great way to offer up our own pains in communion with Jesus for his vicar on earth, Pope Leo. And then there's a special initiative. It was started by Our Sunday Visitor, and they asked lots of co-sponsors for it, including the Pontifical Mission Societies, which I lead, that after Sunday Mass, why don't we have some pizza in honor of Pope Leo, who absolutely loves his Chicago style pizza. And so I think that that's a great initiative, especially if we do what Pope Leo did a few weeks ago and maybe give a slice of pizza to poor people who don't have much to eat around us, or to invite them to join us, or invite lonely parishioners who have no place else to go after Mass. But this Sunday, let's do a worldwide happy birthday to Pope Leo by coming to Mass first, by praying for him with greater devotion, by lifting up the cross together with him, and by having a good agape, a good pizza party after Mass.
We have about 1 minute left, and last week you talked with Ashley about the upcoming beatifications. Just give us a snapshot of the joy and the zeal that you felt after all that happened.
Well, so everybody was able to see that St. Peter's was packed, that the area across from St. Peter's Square was likewise packed. And so we were very joyful that so many young people came to thank God for the gift of the lives of Saint now, Pier Giorgio Frassati, and St. Carlo Acutis. Both of them really lived what we're going to be celebrating this Sunday. Pier Giorgio died of polio when he was 24. Carlo died of leukemia. But both of them, as they were suffering, were offering up their sufferings in union with Christ. Pier Giorgio for the poor that he served and for his dying grandmother, and Carlo Acutis for all the needs of Pope Benedict XVI. And so they teach us what this great feast is, and they're going to be praying from Jesus's right side as they look on Jesus's gloriously transfigured wounds for Betsy Fentress, Monsignor Roger Landry, and the 1.4 billion Catholics across the globe.
Monsignor, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you next week.
God bless you, Betsy.